Shrink Wrap Radio number 660, Living a Life of Service with Shannon Weber, MSW.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today, Shannon Weber, MSW, is an HIV expert, social entrepreneur, TEDx presenter, and author of Show Up Hard, A Roadmap for Helpers in Crisis. For more information about Shannon Weber, MSW, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Shannon Weber, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited for this conversation today.
Well, I'm so excited myself because I just love the things that you are doing and have done in the world. And I had a whole set of notes, which unfortunately got lost. So we're just going to wing it, which will be a new thing for me.
I'm just going to trust that that's the way it was all supposed to happen. Something magical is going to happen.
Yeah, right. Well, I was turned on to you by my son, Jonathan, who's a nurse practitioner, and you've got a background in social work. And so you've come across each other somehow in the course of doing your work. And I know that you've done wonderful things outside of work. And in terms of your paying job currently now, I have the impression that you're working in, which hospital are you attached to?
Yeah, so I'm based at the University of California, San Francisco. I'm in the Department of Family and Community Medicine. And I'm actually right now based at the Mission Bay campus operating a program called pleaseprepme.org, where we help people find the HIV prevention pill called PrEP. And when I met Jonathan, though, I was based at San Francisco General Hospital, still with UCSF and Department of Family and Community Medicine.
Yeah.
But I met him when I was starting the National Perinatal HIV Hotline, and the perinatal hotline is based with the warm line, the PEP line. They now have the PrEP line too. And one of the beautiful things is that these amazing nursing students will come, only the exceptional students, just so you know.
Yeah.
And get hired.
Of course, Jonathan is one.
Of course, because he's the most amazing human. So Jonathan and I met when he was working on the line. And I mean, I am so taken with who he is as a human being. So he is so expansive. And so sometimes people pick these different things they're interested in, which Jonathan may have that very well, but he was so interested in perinatal and my work and how I really felt passionate about people having babies, in addition to all the other things that he would study up on. So that's how we met. And then that's how you and I got introduced.
Yeah. So the work that you're doing it's an HIV line of some sort, and maybe you can bring us up to speed on what's the sort of cutting edge of prevention and treatment of HIV.
Oh, I'd be happy to, because it's super exciting. So Jonathan and I worked together on these telephone hotlines where clinicians would call in and ask questions from all around the country, and then experts that are based at UCSF, San Francisco General Hospital, would answer them. And I've transitioned from that role. I worked there for a decade, and I'm now doing work around PrEP, the HIV prevention pill. And PrEP was approved by the FDA in 2012. It's a safe and highly effective medication that helps people who are HIV negative. If they take the pill in advance of being exposed to HIV, it keeps them from acquiring HIV. So you can imagine super disruptive innovation, right?
Oh, yeah. And I didn't know that so this has moved beyond the cocktail, and this is one pill?
Correct. It's one pill that the CDC recommends is taken once a day. And for people who only have anal sex, there may also be a different dosing strategy called 2-1-1 dosing for people who only need this prevention during certain periods of time. The important thing is that it's safe and highly effective. So it's super disruptive when it comes out in 2012. And, you know, the public health systems and our information is not quite set up to support this kind of messaging getting out. And I had the idea of what it would be like to create a website that would be so welcoming and sex positive and really help people find a provider that would help them figure out if the HIV prevention pill was right for them, and also creating resources or libraries of resources to support providers and frontline workers like navigators, and also people themselves who might be considering whether this medication is right for them. And so I made the website called pleaseprepme.org, and I started with the directory. I first made the searchable location responsive PrEP provider directory for California.
Is PrEP spelled just P-R-E-P? Okay.
Correct. And you see it, the P is capitalized, the R is lowercase, then the E-P is capitalized. And it stands for, because it stands for pre-exposure prophylaxis. So pre meaning you take it before the exposure. And that is kind of built off the term or phrase. So post-exposure prophylaxis, which has been around for a long time, which is you're taking a medication after an exposure to HIV. And many people in the medical field are familiar with that, because if you got a needle stick in a hospital, mm-hmm. you could get this post-exposure prophylaxis. So this is, you know, you might be exposed to HIV, and so you would take the pill in advance. Pre-exposure prophylaxis.
Okay. You and I have something in common, in as much as right after I got my PhD at the University of Michigan, my first job was for the counseling services there mm-hmm. to set up a crisis phone line and to train volunteers.
Now, this
was way back in the age of dinosaurs. It was 1970. And boy, do I ever wish I had your book. Because because you've trained volunteers for a variety of phone crisis lines, and I think it's that history maybe that's kind of given birth to this book. Would I be right?
Correct. That's where the framework that I share in the book, I developed it when I was running the crisis hotline of Houston. This was 1998, so a while ago. And then this framework ended up being helpful in so many other places that I work. I'm sharing it with people.
Yeah.
And so this is how I decided to write the book.
It's a wonderful book. I got so excited reading it because you've got such an original turn of mind and the wording. I don't know if you've got a section. You might in the back of your mind think if there's a place that you'd like to read a passage or two. I've meant to alert you to that possibility beforehand.
Okay. Yeah.
I forgot
to.
Well,
I can do that. I have a book nearby. When you're ready for that, I can grab it.
Okay.
I can absolutely do that.
Okay. Well, let's start off with the title, Show Up Hard. Unpack that for us, because I think that there's a lot of meaning behind that.
Yeah. So what's interesting when you pick a book title is you're looking, and I learned this because I ended up hiring a substantive editor to help me with the book, because I'd written this manuscript based on these trainings I had done. And I could tell based on feedback that there was something there, but it wasn't done. And I actually felt super overwhelmed and depressed about it and was just going to delete the whole thing
because
I didn't know what to do.
Yeah.
So the substantive editor was super helpful for me in helping create this journey and reorganize it. And then I also learned from her that, you know, a title needs to be provocative. People don't pick mm-hmm. up a title unless it stands for something.
Yeah.
And so together, and I tried to think about how we wanted to encapsulate this idea that we often think that empathy or compassion is a soft skill. You mm-hmm. know, it's an afterthought. You know, that there's these more valuable hard skills that people have.
Show up hard sounds kind of tough. You know?
Yeah, but I wanted to encapsulate that it takes guts to do this.
Okay.
It takes courage, and that it is hard. I mean, I think of, like, I cry at work or on the way to or from work so many times because, you know, being this way in the world, it's not easy, it's hard. But there's also those of us who choose to do it. How are we going to do that? And how are we not going to get lost and burn out on the way? So I really wanted to put, like, a stake in the ground and on behalf of empathetic people and social workers, nurses, people doing this very difficult work and say, this is what it means to show up hard, and for us to value ultimately that courage, that the strength, the guts that it takes to do it, and to keep coming and doing it day after day. And I'm hoping with the information in the book to also not burn out.
Yeah, and also you're addressing volunteers, of which there are lots of volunteers, thank goodness, or a lot of the social initiatives and health initiatives couldn't happen, couldn't exist. Yep. And so you honor them, and I feel like it's of interest to my listeners, viewers, to talk to you, because I suspect that they are the kinds of empathetic people, caring people, who want to engage with the world and engage in helpful ways with people. And those are the people that you're talking to, and certainly I could identify with it as I was reading it, and also would have wished for something like this, you know, when I had the responsibility of training up some volunteers, because there's so much solid and feelingful advice in the book.
Thank you. I'm so glad it resonated with you.
Oh, yeah, definitely, definitely. As a matter of fact, I'll share something with you. I usually do a commentary, too, later in the podcast. There'll probably be a commentary about our conversations. And one of the little nuggets I was saving up for that, but I'll spill the beans here, is you had your publisher send me a copy of the book, and that's typically the way this works when I'm interviewing authors. But I went out and I bought the Kindle version for myself because I wanted to be able to read it in bed. I wanted to be able to read it, you know, other places. And I can read more easily with the bright illumination of, of an electronic device. And so, so I already had the book, but I really wanted to have it in a different format.
That you have two versions now.
Really?
Yeah.
I have two versions.
Like,
yes,
you're fully set. You're on the go. You can show up hard. You know, you're at home. You can show up hard. It's good.
Yeah, yeah. So you know, I remember some of the points that came across to me about showing up hard, and I guess the showing up hard part of the hard part of that, I think, is keep your commitments. That is very important, to keep your commitments. And you recognize and praise people in some of the volunteer settings that you've been in who are just so committed, who showed up, you know, all their scheduled times, and ones who go above and beyond.
Yeah, so I see this in the social and healthcare setting so often, that we make heroes out of people who in so many ways do too much. And that there is this, you know, risk that we don't keep those folks around for the long haul because they will burn out. And so with the framework that I share, which I talk about how we can show up and have a misconnection, which is that we didn't share empathy, we didn't create the change we wanted to make, or we can get enmeshed. And with enmeshment, it's ultimately... it's not true. It's not a true way of showing up because it's not sustainable for the long haul. These are the scenarios that ultimately explode or implode, and it can sometimes happen over a short time, or it can take a really long time. But my point being, it is not a true and generous way. And so I offer up a way of showing up called being a compassionate witness.
Yes.
Which is that we bring all of that best part of ourselves. And we do it in a way that's sustainable and true for the long haul. And that we're not responding in the moment, like over-responding, over-committing to something we can't keep up.
Yeah, you give some great examples to kind of help people realize that they need to have good boundaries.
Correct.
Because because loving, empathic people often want to give everything they can. You know, bring the homeless person home with them, or
I have done all these things.
You've done. That's how you know, and you can write so. great guidelines, you know, like, no, that's not appropriate. If you want them to have a home, there's a different volunteer organization that you need to get involved with called Habitat for Humanity. Mm-hmm. And you give a number of examples, you know, saying that's not what this organization is about. What we're about is getting a person through a crisis.
Yep.
And I think you said a crisis typically is maybe 6 to 8 weeks, kind of defined?
Correct. At which point we return to, our body will do everything to return to a homeostasis or a new normal. And so during a crisis period, we actually have an opportunity to create change. And we definitely know people who've had crises in their life and they'll come out of it and say, you know, that made me a better person. We also know people in our life who've experienced crises and then they've had less healthy coping mechanisms come in and their new normal maybe doesn't have them quite at the place that they were before. But the point being is that crisis does not last forever and that we can do our best by showing up for someone who's in crisis by sitting with them in that compassionate witness stance and observing and witnessing their journey. Perhaps we're resourceful, but that's not even required. Like the real requirement and gift we give to people is our presence and that capacity to, I refer to it as love, but it's a space of non-judgmentally holding someone's experience and being there with them while they sort out what their path is. Because man, only they will wake up with the consequences of whatever that choice is, you know, not us. So it really needs to be on them to sort it out.
Yeah, so it's really important not to get enmeshed, not to, because I think we've all had that experience, even just in other kinds of relationships of, whoa, this is getting to be more than I signed up for. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to keep in mind what you've signed up for and not go beyond those boundaries. Now, you come from a family of, you had 14 kids in your
Correct.
Family?
I'm the oldest of 14 kids, 8 of whom are adopted.
Wow. Yep. Wow. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how that plays into who you've become, because I see you here in a good way as kind of, I don't want to say big nurse because that's too negative. That story is too negative. But there's some muscle here in you that comes through of, okay, here's what you need to do.
Yes. I mean, I think there's everything about my growing up relates to who I am today, of course, you know. So I have parents who have a massive capacity for giving, and that was a value that I was taught growing up.
They adopted 8 kids and ended up with 14?
So my parents are extraordinary human beings. And then as you only might imagine, in a house with that many people, that there's things happened. And so I have experience like riding the highs and lows of life from, you know, a somewhat young age. And then as the oldest, I was tasked with responsibility for caring for or, you know, taking care of or helping to organize, because we almost live our house like a little city, you know, because you get assigned a younger sibling to do their laundry, help them with their chores, all these things. So all of that, you know, brought me to where I am today and this deep commitment that I have. Like it is part of my DNA that I was born with to give in a huge way, but also this deep desire to figure out how to do it in a way that, you know, you don't burn out, you don't pull away, because my family is very close to this day. We have found our way to stay close to each other.
Wow.
And that was with a lot of hard work.
Yeah. There's a phrase, I'm blocking on one of the words, the intersection of empathy
and resilience.
And resilience. Yeah. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I introduced the concept of resilience as a different, I would say, or a more expansive way of looking at this concept of self-care. So one of the key things that a compassionate witness needs to do is commit to taking good care of themselves. Mm-hmm. And this is in addition to knowing themselves and being able to notice and create containers. And I think the self-care concept is commercialized, and it's also something people do after the fact. After there's a problem, they go to self-care. And I wanted to examine this as an idea that if you're going to choose this way of being in the world, which I hope you do, because the world needs more people like this. Okay, so if you're going to choose this way of being, you make a commitment to invest in your resilience. Just like we would invest automatically in a savings account or our retirement, how is it that we can, you know, automate these investments in our resilience? And so I do put that term, and I think about a lot, what is that intersection in my life of massive empathy and deep resilience? And at that corner is where I feel like I can be my best self.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting you talk about intersection and corner, because the subtitle of the book is Roadmap for Helpers in Crisis. And yes. So that metaphor of road and maps, mm-hmm. and corners and so on fits into all of that structure.
Yes, I have an obsession with maps. I mean, my Love Note project has a map of Love Notes around the world. My Please Prep Me project is a map, searchable, location responsive, geo tagged map of prep providers. And so it was, of course, this theme about maps ends up coming up in the book, and of then working with the editor really play into that, and then how to take the user on a journey and think about how I'm equipping them with the tools to go on it. So it definitely became purposeful, but it's just funny to me that the book, of course, ended up with a map background, because I have a map thing. We have a giant map in our kitchen my kids and I look at. I love maps.
Yeah. We should mention in passing that you're the mother of three teenagers now?
Yeah, they're 20, 19, and 17.
Oh, and so it's come along since the TED Talk that I saw. I think they were probably younger then.
They were, because I think the TED Talk was maybe 5 years ago.
Okay, and I definitely want to throw that into the conversation, because I want our viewers and listeners to go to your TEDx presentation, which you can find just by searching on Google, search for Shannon Weber, and you'll find a whole ton of stuff. Shannon Weber is all over the place. How about grabbing your copy of the book right now, quickly, if you can.
Okay, I'll do that.
Giving us a little read.
Okay, hang on one sec.
Okay, so this is good. This is us being spontaneous.
Okay, yeah, no worries. It's perfect, because I did a... I had a reading at Green Apple Book here in San Francisco. And so I have a book with some tags in it already, which is why I'm prepared. If we had done this before, I think I might have scrambled a little bit. I think this is actually perfect one for the conversation that we're having.
Good.
And probably also for the people who listen to your podcast, which is, so this is in book two of the book, which is about detour. So in the first section of the book, we already laying out the content about the framework, which you've already shared with your listeners anyways. And so then I spent a little bit of time talking about detours, ways that we can get hung up on this path.
Yeah.
And this chapter is called Confusing Leading with Saving.
Oh, good. Yes.
Which I've been there so many times. It happens to me now with regularity. This is just a thing. It's always something you're in the process of observing yourself. When crisis or challenging situations present themselves and we are in a position to lead, we can be tempted by the seductive flirt of the idea that we might save someone. This temptation is a dangerous detour from the compassionate witness path. Even when our intentions are good, our ego can be seduced by an idea that it's not actually true. I am in frequent dance with my ego. It is a strong, persistent, and ambitious voice that provides regular commentary on my day-to-day life. I have mad respect for and walk closely with my ego for the strength and fortitude to carry forward in daily life. That said, I often need to metaphorically shake hands with my ego and say, "Ease up, sister." Some signs that pop up for me indicating I need to pause and check in with myself are any dynamic I've created where I believe I'm saving someone. I believe I'm the only one who can be there for this person. I've created a self-imposed sense of urgency. I'm working harder than the person I'm helping. Or I believe that there's a reward for me at the end. And whenever I find myself on one of these detours, I pause and have a conversation with my ego. And it goes something like this. Hello, ego. It's good to see you again. And you do a lot of hard work. I want to give you a break around one topic, which is saving people. You've never saved anyone, and you never will. It's just not possible. Mm-hmm. A human being saves themselves. We might tell ourselves a story that we're saving lives or we saved a person. Sure, that story feels good. In reality, we created a structure or provided resources or changed the environment so someone could save themselves. I have mad respect for you, Shannon. So, and then I conclude by saying it's just so critical to understand this point, because the opposite, then, if it's true that we can save someone, then the opposite is true that we're then responsible for the bad outcomes that happen to people. And that's just also a lie, and it would suck if that were true. Mm. So we have to necessarily remove ourselves from the outcome of what happens. And that is what a compassionate witness is able to do. They're able to kind of notice this narrative in their head. Ultimately, I'm very into figuring out how I can feel it in my body, these clues that things are coming up, and then reckon with it and set that on the side and just really be with the other person's story and journey.
Yeah. You know, your book also has that. I love that portion that you read, by the way, because it's so important to not get carried away with our own sense of power. It's like we think we've got enough power to cure, heal, you know, rescue, yeah, all of that. So I really like your emphasis on backing down our ego a bit and coming at it with a lot more humility. Mm-hmm. And I want to let people know that you've got a resources section in the back of the book.
Yep.
And they're good resources. It's like you've suggested some very interesting, relevant books, just a handful, mm-hmm, of books that I haven't read, I wasn't familiar with, but that it kind of made me want to read them. I could see how they would be really supportive for the kind, mm-hmm, of work that you're talking about. And one of the resources that was mentioned that really caught my interest, something called, a book called, or a website, a video, mm-hmm, called A Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows. Do I have that right?
Yes. Okay.
By
so the,
Jack you, Koenig.
Yeah. You are just so right. So it's not listed in resources, but it's one of the quotes I have.
Okay. Yes.
Which talks about. Quote. So my gosh, it's my. I love it. I'm just seeing if I can find it right now. And there's a fabulous little video of it online where they've kind of put some images to this concept of Sonder.
Yeah, I went there. So this guy, just to bring people into this, this guy is in the process of creating, an actual book, and I want to get on the list. I saw I could get on the list to be notified, yep, when the book happens. But of neologisms.
Yeah.
Neologisms, which in a way sounds to me like a hopeless task. It's like, how do you get new words into the language? How do you get them out there enough that people would start to use them? But I think this guy might be able to do it, and clearly you've picked up on it, and you've used it in your book.
Yeah, maybe I read this little quote. I did find,
sure,
it. I find it so powerful because empathy is also a term that gets used so frequently now, and I think it's a little bit been commercialized also that people do these journey maps or, you know, what is someone's user journey through a website or a product? And there's some level, then this is not a bad thing, but it's not this deep level of going, leaving our own worldview and going to see the world through someone else's eyes, which I am and challenging us and saying, like, this is what we have to do to show up for other people. So this quote, Sonder, as defined by the Dictionary of Obscure Sorrows, is the realization that each random passerby is living a life as vivid and complex as your own, populated with their own ambitions, friends, routines, worries, and inherited craziness. An epic story that continues invisibly around you like an anthill sprawling deep underground, with elaborate passageways to thousands of other lives that you'll never know existed, in which you might appear only once as an extra, sipping coffee in the background as a blur of traffic passing on the highway as a lighted window at dusk.
Talk about humbling. That's very humbling. What? I'm an extra in your movie?
Right? Because we have our A roll and B roll going all the time.
Yeah. I was so taken with that, that it motivated me to go online, find this. Do you know anything about the author?
I don't. But now you inspire me to go find out more when we get off.
Okay, good. Well, we mentioned the TEDx presentation. Tell us about some of those projects, those love projects that you've done in the world.
Yeah, so I have, and you may maybe quit really fast before we go there in case we don't come back to this, because you did mention the resource list in the book. So I do want to share that on the website, showuphard.com, I have the resource list. The worksheets are free to download. I also wrote love notes all through the book. They're free to download. So there's heaps of stuff for people to just get right off the website. And actually, it's a good transition to love notes, because why do I have love notes in my book is because actually next year will be the 10-year anniversary of my love note project, which is at loveyou2.org. So LOVEYOU, the number 2.org.
The number what?
The number two. Yeah, okay, loveyou2.org. Yeah.
Okay.
So 10 years ago, I started this love note project. It grew out of a practice I have with my children, which is where I would leave them a little trinket and a love note when I would travel so that they would have something to hold on to and to remind them of our connection. And this became so meaningful, and they, before a challenging thing in their life, like something scary at school or a hard conversation they had to have, they would, even if I was home, they would get one of these, that we called them jujus. It's a little word from my childhood.
What's it called?
Juju. It's a made
juju.
Up word.
A juju. Juju. Okay.
We make up words in my house a lot. Uh-huh. Okay. So we have the juju, and they would choose a juju. And then the other kids and I would say back to them, you know, you've got this. You can do it. You can do this hard thing. And they'd take that little trinket in their pocket and hold it. Well, they'd go do the hard thing. So this was, a huge part of our life, this thing of how are we connected? How do you have proof of this thing that you can't see but you know is real? And one day they said to me, sometimes we need a piece of you even when you are here.
Huh.
And I became so actually overwhelmed by this, because I'm a single parent. I was like, I'm doing really all I can. Like this is like, life is hard. And so for a few days, I think I was kind of annoyed. Like, there's nothing, like, what else can I do for you? And then I realized, oh, it's not even about me. It's about how they see themselves in this experience of being loved by me. Okay. So then I was like, that's a thing I can figure out. How do I give them this knowledge that they are loved, that they have the capacity to tap into that love when I'm not around? That must be what they asked for. So I made this love note, and it says, I love you on the top. And then these pull tabs that say, I love you too on the bottom. You know, kind of like people have for a garage sale, or if they're selling something, you see them hanging up.
Yeah, the little tabs, right? Phone number. Yeah.
Yeah. So instead of the phone number, it said, I love you too. And I put it up on the fridge and I said, there you go. Now, even if I'm here, you need a love note, you need a trinket, you can just pull it right off. You got, it's your thing. And so it really sat on the fridge for a few days and no one touched it. And then one morning I was up early and I walk into the kitchen to get coffee. And even now, as I remember the story, I can just remember how deeply touched I was. I saw that note and it surprised me. And it was like my grandmother, who had passed away the year before, was talking to me, and she said, I love you. I was like, oh my gosh. I pulled a little tab and saying, I love you too, grandma. I put it in my purse. And then I would keep finding the tab, and then I'd remember, my grandma loves me. My grandma loves me. I'm loved. And I mean, it was just a profound experience. So we start hanging this love note, we print them off, we're hanging it up, then friends are hanging it up with us, and someone says, you should start a website. And so I started this website where I put the love note up there and anyone could download it and hang it up and share their story. And it's evolved in the last 9 years to also have little love note templates where I help people host these public displays of affection and write notes where I paint love notes and hang them on their wood signs. And I hang them without permission in public places. And there's a map, so I pin where all these things happen.
Yeah. Folks, you've got to go to this website to believe it. It's because you moved this thing out of your family into the world and have invited strangers into it.
Super fun. All the templates are on the website for free. People can download. And the Love Note templates are in 6 languages now. So I had collaborations with a whole bunch of different community partners for different events, and then they'll help translate the love notes. So they're all free to download for folks too. And I really hope that it just sparks this opportunity that we take this chance to document and to share about how we love each other in these small ways that doesn't require, you know, buying a letterpress card. Those are awesome. I love all kinds of paper. But these are just supposed to be these very easy prompts, and that we can widely share them with people. That doesn't have to be just people in our family, but we can share them with, you know, coworkers, neighbors in our community.
Yeah. You've got another thing, the superhero project?
Yes. I gave Jonathan a cape because he's a superhero, of course. Yeah. Jonathan was early on a superhero.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, the capes, I put that on the LoveNet website too. And I started that because I nominated someone that I admire very much for a prize, and they didn't get the award.
Uh-huh.
So I was like, I'm just going to make my own award. And so then I was thinking, wow, what award could I give people? And I thought, well, who does not like a cape? Everyone would like a cape. So I started.
And what do you make the capes out of?
Oh, really beautiful fabrics. And often I'm trying to think about the person, who they are, their personality, and what that fabric might be like, but it's often some kind of, you know, a little bit shiny or sparkly fabric.
Yeah. There are pictures of them, I think, on the website or
in
the book someplace.
You checked it all out. It's on the website.
Yeah. That's wonderful. Are there other projects we haven't gotten to yet?
Well, let's see. Now I have to think through myself. I think we might have covered it. Love notes, capes, please prep me, the book. Kids, I think we got it.
Yeah. Okay, let me just take a look back at the book and see if there's anything that gets triggered by looking at the table of contents. Yeah, the detours, the... Yeah, let me just read some of these, some of the chapter titles, and maybe it'll evoke something that you want to say or that I want to say.
Great.
So you've got a framework for showing up. Oh, you've got the trip here. So the first, it's three parts or three books. It's only this thick, so three books, don't be
intimidated. I wanted to make it easy for you to show up.
Easy, right.
Yeah.
Embarking is the first part, and under that we've got a framework for showing up. Put yourself on the to-do list. So it's so easy to kind of get lost and to be generous with other people and to kind of leave our... Some people habitually do that, right?
Yep. Yeah. That's part of that martyr
or
enmeshed way of showing up.
Yeah.
And that's a whole story we tell ourselves. Look at me. Look how much I do for other people.
Right.
And in the end, it's not sustainable because you haven't invested in your own resilience and then that capacity, that strength that it takes to show up for others.
Yeah. You know, something kind of like that is when I was teaching university, I would, on Valentine's Day, I would have the students write a Valentine to themselves.
Oh, I love that idea. Yeah. See, you do love notes too.
Yeah. Well, I did in that context, yes.
I love it.
Yeah. Another one that was interesting is leading is a posture. So that sort of suggests something very physical. But what were you getting at? Leading is a posture.
That's a great question. And I think, you know, it's one of the bits that I felt important to put in there. So my goal was, if I'm talking with people in social and healthcare setting, a lot of times they don't feel like they're a leader, so to speak, because they don't have that title or that position that people associate with leadership. And I'm trying to, you know, take that apart and talk about, hey, you have this thing that people think is a soft skill that is like the hardest thing to do. And when you can do the hardest thing to do, which is be empathetic and compassionate for someone else, that is creating change. And that's what leaders do. So I really wanted people reading the book to feel empowered to recognize the capacity they have to create change, and then to see themselves in that place of possibility that, you know, that one person who chooses to show up in this way and chooses to do these practices can be leading a new way of being.
You want them to own it, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Own it. Put it into your posture. Don't be a shrinking violet.
Yep.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's what I got. And you say empathy is an adventure.
Yes.
And you gave some wonderful examples in there, as I recall.
Yeah, I have a practice in there called, well, I call it stamping my passport.
Yeah.
And it's a
the journey again.
Yes.
We're traveling internationally now.
There's going to be a
passport.
Map.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when I was in college, I did work. I worked in Switzerland in a grocery store, and so we would work Tuesday through Saturday. We'd get paid in cash. We had Sunday and Monday off, and we'd go travel. And I mean, I loved every day working in that grocery store. I loved the people, and then I loved getting my cash and going and traveling. And I adore getting these stamps in my passport. And it became this whole thing where it didn't necessarily matter if I loved the hostel I stayed in or I loved the food. Like, I'd still come back and with my host family, I'd be like, look, here's the stamp in my passport. And so I say in the book, what's it like if we give ourselves that kind of permission to go on these empathy adventures? So I don't have to change my political views, but I could free myself to just go stamp my passport. And what's it like to sit in the shoes of and see the world through the eyes of someone who has different political views than I do,
mm-hmm.
or different growing up experience or different living situation
yeah.
than I do? All these things. And I don't have to stay there. I don't have to commit to it. But this is the practice of being able to actually be compassionate for someone, is the leaving of our own worldview. And so I do talk about it being a journey, because we have to make that choice. Like, our worldview and the way we internally kind of knit ourselves together and hold ourselves together is an important way of keeping ourselves, you know, together in life. To be compassionate, we need to leave that and go see how is someone else doing that.
Yeah. I felt challenged by that. I mean, you talk about reaching out to a homeless person on the street and having a meal with them. You know, some good, very challenging examples. And so I had to look at myself and say, could I do that?
You know? Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Tell me more.
Now I'm getting self-conscious here. Tell you more. I think I did a little bit of it today in the gym, because there's this very nice woman there who I know is a Christian. I grew up with a lot of Christianity, and I kind of left that. So I was a little bit offended when there was an exercise in our senior exercise class, where the leader had us walk around the room and say something that, I don't remember what it was, maybe say something that you're thankful for today. And she said, and I didn't know this woman, you know, and she said, I'm thankful that the Lord Jesus came to save my soul, or something like that. And I was just like, it rubbed me the wrong way.
Yeah.
But today, many months later, sitting side by side on stationary bikes, she told me she was reading, I'm going to block on the big psychedelic book.
Michael Pollan's book?
Michael Pollan. I can't believe she's reading Michael Pollan's book.
Fascinating.
I'm surprised. And then she started to say that she kind of, he started expressing some kind of spiritual view that she wasn't sure she was with. So I began to sort of query her about that, and we kind of began to have a conversation. And I think it was partly influenced by, you know, what I read here.
I love it.
Yeah, because instead of sort of turning off to her, I began to draw her out a little bit and let her know about, okay, I've got some Christian background as well. And the place where I got off the boat was I went away to college, and I loved the guys I was meeting in college, and I didn't see how I could subscribe to a God that would send them to hell. I was able to share that with her. She was able to hear it, you know, and it kind of opened up a nice, that's a conversation I'm sure that will continue.
I love it. You're the one who did it. What's interesting too is, I mean, from whatever assumptions we make about her from that one comment, she appears to be on her own empathy adventure reading a book that's probably outside her worldview. And books and movies are a great way for us to start building that muscle.
Right.
You know, so I think with the caution that sometimes we can have books and movies that have a lot of white people at the middle and a lot of maleness at the middle. So I think we have to also be unpacking these things. But movies and books are a great way to challenge ourselves. Like, okay, pick up that book of something that you don't have to become that on the other side, but why? How did that person get there?
Yeah.
And then it's so interesting to watch you share this story, and like, you're actually connected with her now. Like, there's a little part of you that cares.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So let's see.
Well done. You stamped your passport. You get a passport stamp. Boom.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Empathy is an adventure. That was... Was that? Yeah. Skills to build for the journey.
Mm-hmm.
What are some of the skills that people need to build for this journey?
Well, one of them that I put in there is a little bit that we talked earlier about the piece about crisis and just like a little bit of the background. So I didn't want to, you know, have a lot of theory in this, but just really understanding that how limited crisis is and what an opportunity it is. So we just have a sense of that. And also the skill of listening. So I realized, even if you learn all these things and you don't recognize the value of listening, you're going to be, you know, you'll be off track.
You told a good story on yourself in there.
I sure did.
Where when you were a student and that instructor paired you up with somebody, had you pair up with somebody and to do a helpful conversation of some sort and record it. So it was like supervision. And you listened. When you listened back, you didn't want to even share it with your supervisor because you realized that you were doing 80 or 90% of the talking.
Yep. I was like kind of, oh, I want my supervisor to see how smart I am. Look at me. And I mean, I'm like 21 years old and the person is a client and she's a mom. Like, what do I know? And I had the most wonderful field supervisor. This is when I was in grad school and she was fabulous. She says, why did you do this? And I said, I wanted you to think I was smart. You know, it matters to me what you think. And she was like, okay, go back and do it again.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then the next time I sat and I went to the client, and I said, this is what happened. I talked way too much. And you know, because we get permission, of course, to record it. And I know I wanted my supervisor to think I was smart. And because I really like her, she knows my supervisor. She is amazing. Okay, can we do it again? And then the next time every time I'm speaking, I'm like, what's going to happen when I have to type this out?
Yeah.
We had to type out the transcript ourselves
on an actual typewriter. Right. You know, what I'm just remembering is there were a couple places in the book where you refer to a next book.
Do I?
You're going to be held to that now.
You know what? I can't remember where they are now, but I do remember the editor told me that too. I don't remember doing that on purpose. But I think my point when I was writing, no, I remember now my point. My point was trying to limit, like, that's what this book is for. This book, I wanted it to be small and easy to use, easy to pick up. So I would say that's a different book, you know, such topic. Like, for example, a deep dive on crisis theory, different book. I don't know necessarily. I have ideas for other books to write, but I can't say that I have a plan.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Would not surprise me to hear that you have ideas for other books.
And, I have ideas.
But I don't want to heap any more on your plate, you know, than needs to be there that you're prepared to take on. Well, how did we do here, doing this on the fly, me having no notes? What do you think?
Well, here's what I would say. You have a remarkable capacity for remembering a very diverse set of things. People don't usually, you know or about all the different parts of my life or have kind of context for them. And so I would just say back, well done. Maybe writing the notes helps you remember. I have no idea, but your brain seems to be doing a great job.
Well, that's very reassuring because I've been worried about my brain and memory. So that's good. I think we had a good conversation, and I wanted to rise to the challenge of being really present with you because I so admired the way that you were championing that, and you know, and illustrating it in your book and in your YouTube talk and so on. So
great.
Yeah. Shannon Weber, I want to thank you for being my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm so grateful that for Jonathan, by the way. Thank you for making him. And that's what connected us.
I was so pleased to be referred to Shannon Weber, MSW, by one of my sons, Jonathan, who I believe was in an HIV crisis line training with her. He raved about her qualities as a person, and I can certainly see why. Her book, Show Up Hard, A Roadmap for Helpers in Crisis, is written with great authority and verve. In fact, I usually don't have to pay for the books written by the authors I interview because they send them to me. It's one of the perks of the job. So while I had a paperback copy of Shannon's book, I decided to go ahead and purchase a Kindle version to read on my iPhone and iPad. Because of their bright screens, I can read them more easily than the actual print versions. I was so excited by her book that I actually shelled out money for a digital version. In my 15 years of interviewing authors, this is the first time that's happened. So I think this should give you an idea of how highly I value her work. I think Shannon's book will have wide appeal for helpers of all stripes, including professionals and volunteers. Shannon has been responsible for setting up a variety of crisis lines and training the volunteers for them. Right after I got my PhD from the University of Michigan, I was hired by their counseling services office to set up a suicide crisis line and train the volunteers. This was back in 1970, and I looked for helpful resources to guide me through the process. I really could have used this book back then. There was nothing comparable back then, and I think it's fairly unique even now. The book grew out of the training documents that Shannon wrote for her various crisis trainings. The Show Up Hard title communicates that while many people think of skills such as compassion and deep listening as soft, they actually take serious work and commitment to refine. The title also communicates the necessary expectation that crisis staff will keep their commitments and show up with an intensity of purpose. The subtitle, A Roadmap for Helpers in Crisis, reflects Shannon's love for maps in general and also provides a metaphor of the journey she is inviting the reader on. It's not only about helping others, but very much about how to do the work of being a compassionate witness without burning out. She warns of some of the pitfalls along the way, such as enmeshment, overpromising, not setting needed boundaries, and failure to nurture oneself for the long haul. Her book aside, I'm particularly charmed by Shannon's openness and her courageous acts of love in the wider world. To learn about those, I suggest you be sure to watch her TEDx presentation on YouTube and other videos she's produced there. And do visit her websites, which are xoshannonweber.com. And Shannon is spelled S-H-A-N-N-O-N, Weber.com, showuphard.com, loveyou2.org, and that's capital L-O-V-E, capital Y-O-U, and the numeral 2.org, and pleaseme.prepme.org, that's spelled capital P L-E-A-S-E, capital P, small r, capital E, capital P, capital M, small e, dot org. I don't know if all those capitals and lowercase matter in the web addresses, but I suspect they might. And it's worth taking a look at these, so be sure to do it. And also, if listening to me try to spell them out was difficult, I encourage you to go to shrinkwrapradio.com and read the show notes there, and the live links to those websites will be there, and all you have to do is click on them.
This is Ted Leckie. I'm an EFT couples therapist practicing in Toronto. I've been listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for years and love the breadth of modalities and therapeutic ideas I have been exposed to by listening. I can't count the number of books I have ended up buying after listening to your interviews, following up on wonderful new directions. Thanks so much, Dr. Dave. Your podcast is much appreciated.
Thank you, Ted, for that expression of appreciation. I really appreciate you in return. And thanks to the following recent donors, Heiko Kochius, F. Andrew Fanier, and Karen Ferry. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up once again for today. Thanks to today's guest, Shannon Weber, MSW, for sharing her insights and recommendations on showing up hard and for her sparkling and inspiring self. Next week, I'll be speaking with author Anne Boudreau about her book, The Human Mosaic, Heal, Renew, and Develop Self-Worth, which is based on nearly 7 years of research, interviews, and meetings with over 40 trauma survivors. So I hope you will join us for what I'm sure will be a very fascinating discussion. And until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.